The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Ms. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Plasencia.
Here.
Vice Chair Maney.
Here.
Representatives Casello.
Here.
Grego. Hawkins.
Here.
Magard, excused. Mariano, excused. McCurdy.
Here.
Nixon. Rizzo.
Here.
Rodriguez.
Here.
Schoaf, excused. Ranking Member Thompson. Tuck.
Here.
Zika.
Present.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Members, today you're going to be hearing from two different groups. You're going to have an individual, and then you're going to have a great panel that we have in store for you. Last year, in both proviso and conforming bill, we had the words low cost, no cost, and open access electronic textbooks added. Our intention is to move in that direction as the world becomes more digital and as our universities continue to move in that direction, and to a certain extent, our K-12 and our state colleges as well. The education industry is moving in that direction, rightfully so. We want to make sure that we're proactive as a body and making sure that we are engaged in that conversation and not an impediment to any growth that's possible in open access and low cost and no cost electronic textbooks. So members, today we will be starting with a presentation and overview on the implementation of 2021 HB 847 by Dr. John Opper of the Florida Academic Library Network. Following this overview, I will introduce panelists from both the Florida college system and the state university system to discuss some of the innovative things the institutions are doing in the area of low cost, no cost, and open access electronic textbooks. At the conclusion of Dr. Opper's presentation, I will open it up for questions from committee members. At that time, the panelists may come up, find their name card, and take a seat. Please be sure and fill out an appearance form if you have not already. I will introduce each panelist, and they will be given approximately 5 minutes to provide a brief overview of their institution's work. Then I will open up the meeting to committee members for discussion on the issues, and so you may ask any questions you may have. Dr. Opper, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, it's a pleasure to address you today and talk with you about some of the work that we've been doing over the last year and certainly the last 10 years on some of these issues. So I'd like to start with giving just a brief overview of the results of House Bill 847. It was passed by the legislature last year. It established the Florida Postsecondary Academic Library Network. It consolidated a range of resources and also some responsibilities for the operation of a centralized library system in the state of Florida. The coordination and operation of a distance learning online catalog, and some centralized advising services. Many of those services have been in place for a while, and this bill sought to tweak a number of things as well as reestablish the Florida Postsecondary Academic Library Network for ongoing operation. The organization was housed administratively at Florida State University, and it is under the banner of the Florida Virtual Campus. Florida Virtual Campus is a name that most everyone knows us by. It's the one the students know us by, and it's one that we are known nationally by. So that's the brand that we essentially use for our services. One of the specific pieces of the bill and part of the statute that was assigned to us was the promotion and to provide recommendations concerning the use and distribution of low-cost, no-cost, or open-access textbooks. And education resources, and to look at innovative pricing techniques that comply with all applicable laws in regards to copyrighted material and statewide accessibility measures as a method for reducing cost. Reducing textbook cost has been something that's been on our radar for over 10 years. This is certainly something we've worked on, and I'm going to talk with you a little bit about some of those activities today. Certainly, there are four areas that we've been working on principally. Open Florida is something that exists within our organization. It is a community of practice for faculty, administrators who are working on open educational resources or the provision of resources to eliminate, essentially, or reduce the commercial textbook usage in many of our courses, so students don't have that expense. Open Florida shares best practices and provides resources to faculty and our institutions who are working in that area. We also created a set of standards and checklists for faculty to review or to use in reviewing resources they can use for their courses. The checklists include things like accessibility, whether or not it's accurate, the quality standard. It's things that help faculty make a decision about which types of resources they would like to use in their courses if they're going away from a commercial textbook. We also have held 4 summit meetings. These summits are 2-day events. We bring together Florida faculty and administrators from all across the state in for 2 days to focus on a particular topic. These particular summits were focused totally on how faculty can develop and curate their own resources for their courses and use them so they don't have to have students buy a textbook. We've had a lot of success, and those summits attract over 200 people when we've done them. Prior to those summits, we also had 2 previous summits on textbook affordability itself, and we involved commercial textbook publishers and people from all over the country and other state systems to talk to us about methods and activities they had taken on to reduce textbook costs in their state. And finally, we also have been doing a textbook affordability student survey. We have done that 4 times, and I want to talk with you a little bit about the results of that survey from its last administration in 2018 in a little bit. One of the ways that we got into the textbook issue was my side of the house is essentially distance learning, and we discovered some 15 years ago when students started taking courses remotely and their institution where they were taking the course was on the other side of the state, the concern was how do they get the textbook? How do they get the resource? Because the bookstore for that institution was miles away, hundreds of miles away. And so we started looking at options for students. And of course, about that time, the commercial textbook publishers came up with digital textbooks. We started to see those emerge on the scene. And one of the problems was that the cost for a digital textbook was about the same as a hard copy textbook. And so that was not helping students. But it was making access and delivery easier, but the cost issue was still there. So we started to look more broadly at the issue of how we might be able to impact this issue, make these resources more accessible for students, as well as maybe reduce the cost. So as you look at this, and many of you may have seen a chart like this one shows the percentage of increase since 2002 on a number of indices. You'll see the red one is actually medical costs. The orange one at the top is textbook costs. So textbook costs have increased over time by a percentage higher than medical cost, housing expenses, and certainly the consumer price index. A similar book, here's another one from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which compares the rate of inflation, which is the yellow bar, and then the cost of textbooks is the orange bar. You get a sense of that. So this is a concern, and it's something students deal with every day. So as we started to dig into this a little bit, the question was, let's ask the students. Let's find out what they're experiencing and what they feel about this. So we put together a survey, and in 2018 was the last administration. We had 21,000 students respond to the survey. It's something they wanted to talk about, obviously. The window was about 6 weeks we gave them to respond. All of our college universities participated in this. There were 14 questions, and we tried to make it only take 10 minutes to complete the survey. We don't take a lot of student time. The next administration of the survey is planned for the spring of 2022, when we will once again ask students their opinions. But let me take a minute and go through some of the highlights for what we found when we did the survey in 2018. If you'll look at this, this is a comparison of the results of 2016 and 2018. The blue bar is the 2016 survey. So you'll see from that graph that the majority of students, 53%, said that they were spending over $300 a semester on their textbook. When we did it in 2018, it almost flip-flopped. You'll see that we had 56% say that they were spending less than $300 on their textbook. Now, we would chalk this up to the efforts of our colleges and universities to try to reduce textbook costs. They've been working on this for a while, and certainly the legislature has a textbook affordability statute. That has also helped. And so we think that that has impacted student costs. So for the first time since we did the survey, we saw students indicate that they were spending a little bit less than they had been previously. When we asked them how they were doing it, what they were doing to measure their, to handle their costs, students came back and said the majority of them, the biggest change from 2016 to 2018 was in rental textbooks. In other words, students can go to the bookstore and they would rent a textbook. Originally, when rental programs came out before 2016, you could rent a textbook, but you couldn't write in the textbook. You couldn't bend pages in the textbook. You had to take really good care of the textbook. And if you've seen students in backpacks, you know, maybe not so good. If you damaged the book, you wrote in the book, or you highlighted in the book, you own the book. You had to buy the book. So students weren't really interested in doing that. So rental programs then freed up, and they said, no, you can write in the book. You can do some things. So they eased up on that. So there's been more acceptance between 2016 and 2018 in rental programs, and students saw that as a way to reduce their costs by renting a textbook and then giving it back to the bookstore and saying, I don't need this book anymore. I don't need to have it. So it was appealing to them, and you'll see we had almost a 12% increase in students accepting rental programs. You'll also see that the tried and true methods that many of you may have heard about also saw an increase. Students are sharing books with their classmates. They're also buying used copies from the campus bookstore, which is a tried and true method that students have used for some time. The other issue with rental textbooks, though, is it's okay if you don't need that book, because once you turn it back in, it's gone. If you bought a textbook, you own the book. You can keep it for as long as you want. In some cases and for some courses, it doesn't matter. You can give the book back. You're not going to need it again. But for some disciplines where you have to take an end-of-program exam or a licensure exam, you may want that book. You may need that book. And a rental program means that you don't have the book. So it may or may not suit the need for students in all cases with rental programs. I want to spend just a few minutes on this slide. We asked students, what was the impact of the cost of textbook on your college career? These were concerning to us, and we have tracked them for two administrations. 64% said that they did not purchase a required textbook because it was too expensive. 43% said they took fewer courses. 41% said they did not register for a specific course because of the cost of the textbook. 36% said they felt they earned a poor grade because they couldn't afford to buy the textbook. And many, 23% said they dropped a course. Now, this is considerably concerning. This helps no one. This doesn't help the student. This doesn't help our colleges and universities. And it doesn't help the state of Florida. If a student drops a course, puts off a course, or performs poorly in a course, and in that course is one that they have to complete for their degree program, they've extended their time at the university or college by another semester. That's increased the student's cost significantly. So anything that delays student progress or puts it off is a problem. So we were quite concerned with this. Since the 2016 administration, these numbers came down slightly, which is good news. It means that the efforts that our college universities have been undergoing to manage this have having some impact, we believe. But this is concerning, certainly, for time to degree issues, as well as the cost of students to extend their college career by another semester when maybe they didn't have to. We also asked them, of the required textbooks that you, of the books you were required to buy over the course of your academic career, how many of them did you not use? And you'll see in 2012, 1.6 was the average, 2016, 2.6, and now in 2018, when we last did this, roughly 3.5, 3.6. So we were concerned that this number was going up at the same time when everybody was working to try to reduce textbook costs. So we dug into this just a little bit. We believe that there are, what's happening here is it's a consequence of bundling. A student will buy a package, a textbook with a software code on the top of the textbook, or maybe a bundle. And they'll take that software code off and they'll go online and they'll get access to a platform offered by the publishers, and maybe it's My Math Lab or it's some environment where they have access to PowerPoint slides and things like that, which is great. And the faculty member has the same thing. They have PowerPoint slides. So everything the student needs, or a lot of what the student needs, is digital and it's on the computer. And that textbook is probably wrapped in plastic and it's never touched again. And so we think some of the students, when we ask this question, are reacting to the fact that they bought a textbook with a software code and they feel like they never used that book. We think that's maybe part of the bundling factor that's happening with this particular question. But it is a concern because, you know, can we reduce cost by not requiring a physical book? Maybe make that optional? It's a good question to ask. So we've been following that one. So when you think about ways that we can mitigate textbook costs, what can we do? One of the biggest ones, you've heard me use the phrase open educational resources. There are two phrases that are often intertwined here, open access and open educational resources. Open access means that you can access it. You can read it, you can see it on the internet, but it doesn't mean that you can change it, reuse it, or adapt it. Open educational resources have what we call the five R's, and you see them there on the slide. You can retain the content, you can reuse the content, you can revise the content, you can remix it any way you want, and you can redistribute it. This is appealing for faculty members who are trying to take a piece of content and mold it to fit the needs of their course. Most faculty would probably tell you that when they buy a commercial textbook, as good as it might be, it may not perfectly fit their course. They're using parts of that book and other things that they have in class. In this case, with an open educational resource, they can actually mold that content with this type of license where they can just change it and use it any way they choose. So open educational resources, when we say that, we mean it's a resource that they can actually mold, change, and reuse the way that they need to use. The other way that many states have tried and been working is leverage negotiation. To essentially say to a textbook publisher, we are buying a lot of textbooks. Let's talk about a discount, a better pricing agreement. Normal process. You have to have two pieces in place to do that effectively. One, you have to know the volume. You have to know how many textbooks you're going to buy. And you have to be able to say to the publisher, we're going to buy 5,000 of your textbooks, or 10,000, whatever that is. And often we don't know that because students may or may not buy the book. In some states, they have a textbook fee, and that fee forces the student to pay a fee. So the college or university can say, we're going to buy 5,000 textbooks, and they know they're going to buy 5,000 textbooks, and they know those textbooks are going to be paid for by a student fee. We've had some conversations in the state in the past about this, and it's always been the feeling that we don't want to force students to pay a fee when they can maybe find the book another way. But that's something that you sort of have to have in place. We've not had that in Florida to negotiate that. I'm not arguing for it. I'm just saying we don't have that. Our students can opt in and opt out and choose what they want to do to get their best textbook pricing. Textbook rental programs I mentioned, and I mentioned some of the weaknesses of those programs, those have come on strong, and we certainly have low-cost providers. Some of you who may have studied this may have heard of these two companies, OpenStax or Lumen Learning. OpenStax was founded at Rice University. It's funded heavily by foundations, and they have a whole catalog of open access textbooks. A faculty member can go to the OpenStax website, can search through their resources. If they find a book that they want to use that OpenStax has, they can use it. It costs nothing. They just put a link in their syllabus for that book, and the students can access the book, and if there are any resources that go with the book, they can access those as well. In some cases, OpenStax may have some resources where they partnered with a commercial company to provide an additional resource. The student can choose to purchase that or not purchase that. It tends to be more tutorial or academic support resources for a student. But this model has worked very well for a lot of schools and universities who are working with OpenStax. OpenStax also offers something that many students find attractive, and that simply is that they can purchase a hard copy of that book for $30. If they want a hard copy, they can have it, and they can buy it for $30, and they can do whatever they want to do with it. So it doesn't require it, but it's offered. Lumen is something is similar in the sense that they offer their textbooks in the same way, except they charge $25 a head for whatever the class is. So if you have 20 people in the class, it's $25. Students can, some schools charge that as a fee where they have a fee situation where they can do that, not in Florida. But in Florida, typically, if they want to use a Lumen Learning Resource, a student can just pay that with credit card for $25. $25 seems to be among a lot of students an acceptable number that they'll pay for a textbook. Typically, a student, according to the College Board, will spend about $1,300 a year on textbooks and instructional materials. That's the average. In some professions, or I should say some disciplines, that number may be higher. We've seen some of the books in some of the health professions go much higher than that. Pharmacology books or areas where things are pretty hefty, anatomy books, can be more expensive. And then we have new programs. You may have heard terms like inclusive access or subscription services. These are situations where a commercial textbook publisher is making a digital copy of the textbook and or instruction materials available to the students for a fee. So students typically will pay a per credit hour fee. It may be anywhere from $5 to $20 a credit hour, or in some cases, depending upon the model, it could be a flat fee. But they pay a fee, and then they get access to digital content that's needed for the course, a digital textbook. It may also include slides or other materials as well. The issues with inclusive access are that simply the per credit hour fee may be too high for some students to pay. It's the same issue that we have with students. Can they afford to pay the fee? In Florida, we have an opt-in, opt-out policy. If the student opts in to the program, then they're billed. In some cases, student opts out. It means everybody assumes the student will participate unless the student opts out of the program. If they don't opt in or opt out by a certain date, they get a bill for the resource. Issue with inclusive access is the same that I mentioned with rental. It's basically you're paying to play. At the end of the semester, it goes away. You don't have the resource anymore. For some professions and some disciplines, you may want that. You may want that book. You may want that material. So we cannot argue that when you have a situation where a textbook may have formerly cost, in the case of an anatomy book or something like that, may have cost as much as $300 for the textbook, $20 a credit hour, $10 a credit hour is a reasonable savings for a college student at that point. But they may need that book later. That's the question. So you kind of have to do the numbers and figure out if it's worth it. Students, as I say, well, they like to do a lot of ways to avoid these costs. We've heard stories of students where they live together, three students live together. They'll buy one set of books for the courses, take the same courses, and share the books. The issue with inclusive access and rental programs is it sort of eliminates the used textbook market. There are no used textbooks. It's all digital. It goes away. So one of the ways that students have in the past mitigated their expense is to buy used copies. What do you do when there aren't any used copies? It's not available to you. So the business model changes, and students are adapting as best they can. But it is an issue for students in terms of trying to afford the textbooks and instructional resources. All of our college universities have been working very hard to not only work with their faculty to develop open educational resources in support of their courses and programs, but also to explore a lot of these programs to see if they can reduce the cost for students. Our faculty are obviously trying to select the best possible resource they can for their class, mitigate the cost for students, but also give them the best resource so they can learn the content as well as they can. So it's a little bit of a tug of war. You want the best resource you can get, but you also don't want to have the student have to pay so much because, as a survey suggests, students won't buy the textbook. They'll avoid it. And the consequences for that are not good for anyone. So I would say to you that we've made progress. We've seen some numbers start to come down. We'll learn a lot more in the spring when we administer the textbook survey again. But it's clear that the textbook cost issue has negatively impacted students. It's clear that students are spending a little bit less on textbooks, so we're hopeful, and we think that the efforts of our institutions and everybody working on this problem has actually helped it to some degree. There is increased acceptance on the availability of some of these cost reduction strategies by students, rental programs, and others. Students will do whatever they can to save money in any way that they can. And it is clear that we have increased the use of open educational resources. And open educational resources are, you know, 2 years ago it was a new term. A lot of faculty weren't aware of it. I think now almost everybody understands this term. And in some cases, we have some of our institutions who have adapted whole large segments of their curriculum to just open educational resources. We have some institutions where you can complete the entire AA degree using courses that have no textbook costs. So there's been some progress, and it's been good work, but there's more to do. In some disciplines where the content changes very rapidly, it's very difficult to keep up without using a commercial resource. In some cases, those commercial resources are expensive. So, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, members. Are there any questions or comments? Representative Hawkins, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of your earlier slides, you talked about that it had went down, like the cost had been mitigated. What were some of the things the universities have done to mitigate those costs? Unless I think I saw that slide.
Let me back up just a minute. See. That one?
I don't know if that was. I should have marked it on here on my page. But are there? Has it gone down, or did I miss hear what
the
you said?
Cost the yeah. Well, the students have indicated they're spending less.
Right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hopper and any of our panelists and any of our members, you are free to speak without having to go through the chair. Obviously, as long as it's respectful, I don't want to disrupt the flow of your Q&A. So feel free to just not have to go through the chair on these questions.
We have seen an increase in the number of courses that are using open educational resources, eliminating textbooks. So we know as a group that that's part of the calculation. We also have seen our college universities adopt rental programs, as I mentioned, and a number of these other strategies. So in some cases, they're working for students. But there are some concerns, as I mentioned, about some of the programs. So you really have to do the math and think about, does this really work for me? If I were a student, and you know, my daughter's graduated now, but she was a dental hygienist student, and we had some expensive books to buy. And her first thing she would do is go to the bookstore and get the ISBN numbers and search Amazon and search around and see if she could find that book cheaper or find a used copy. And students are doing those things. And bookstores, according to the textbook affordability statute, require students to be able to get those ISBN numbers so they can do those searches. Okay. So that's helped. Okay. All those things have helped.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple more. The surveys that you're doing, do you find any discrepancies between different colleges in the answers?
I'm sorry?
Discrepancies in the answers from different schools throughout the state in the surveys?
We didn't really break it down by institution, but pretty much I think when we did look across all of them, the answers are pretty consistent across all of them. There is no significant difference that we saw across universities versus colleges. We did look at that because we thought maybe the content was different. We didn't see that. We did see some differences in textbook cost according to discipline, as you might expect.
Mr. Chairman, just one last one. You talked about by going digital, there not being any used books. Do we know what the average lifespan of a book is used, how many times it's resold or anything like that, that we could, or how often a professor may change the course material to know if digital is the way to go? I'm just trying to figure between a hard copy and a digital copy, how that would work.
There has been some concern expressed among the education community about what we call rapid change in versioning, where you have a textbook 1 year and then you have version 10 and version 11, version 12, and the only difference between them is a page number change or one chart. And what that ends up doing, it causes a number of problems. One, the faculty member who may have a course and assignments designed around certain page numbers in the textbook has to rechange everything in the course. But second, it may force the student to buy a new textbook when the old textbook is perfectly fine for that. So the textbook affordability statute that's in place puts some parameters around that and expresses some concern and asks institutions to use a textbook for at least about 3 years. If there is some need to change it more rapidly, then it can be done, but it requires some approvals at the institution level. So everybody's concerned about versioning.
But digital can take care of that a lot quicker and more efficient.
Digital can take care of that depending upon how you access the digital.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rizzo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. My question is on digital textbooks. The trend seems to be that they're being rented at a much greater rate, correct? So my question is their cost increasing? Is it decreasing? Is it flattening out? How is that relative to that increase in usage for digital text?
At first, the textbook companies priced the digital product almost the same as the hard copy product. In the face of a lot of pushback from our college universities across the country over that, and some really good commentary by economists who talked about the marginal cost of adding a digital textbook to one more student, the prices were driven down in the market. I suspect also that the push to use more open education resources has also put some pressure on the market. So I would say to you that the digital product prices have come down from what they originally were. But these subscriber programs, and I would say the use of them has probably reduced some of the cost, but you still get to the point of it whether the student can afford to pay for the digital product.
Right.
And there isn't another alternative to get the digital product like there is with a physical textbook. You can buy a used copy, there are other ways. There isn't another way to get the digital product. And quite frankly, as a business model, if you can eliminate your biggest competition, which is used textbooks, by going digital, then it's a good move, right? And the marginal cost for a company to add one more person to a digital platform versus shipping out a physical textbook is significant.
Thank you.
Representative McCurdy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. It sounds like a great idea, right? And for us to convert to digital textbooks, my question is there any pushback from any of the state colleges and universities? Would there be a fiscal impact to the colleges and universities if there's a complete conversion? And do you, in part two of that, do you see any pushback from any of the state colleges and universities from fully converting to digital textbooks?
I'm not sure. I think they should probably respond to that later in the panel. I have not heard from any college or university who is overly concerned about moving to digital. Their biggest concern is about the impact on students. And one of the things that we heard from students in the earlier iterations of the survey was they wanted physical paper. Now, I think there's been more acceptance over the last 4 years of a digital product because we're all used to reading things on our computers now much more than we were. But a lot of students want to write in something. And so in some cases, for example, if you have a digital product like a digital textbook where you have access, can you print it? In some cases, you couldn't. Now, in most cases, you can print some pages. So if you can do that, students can write on what they need to write on and study the way they want to learn. But in some of the earlier models with the digital product, there was a lot of concern about the digital product getting away, getting on the internet, and the publisher losing control of their resource, which is a real concern. And so they locked it down. And so that also restricted the ways in which students could use that product. But I think it's opened up just a little bit more, and students are able to print and pages they need and do what they need to do in the newer digital products. But that's a question probably to ask my colleagues in the panel who will be up later.
Representative Zika, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. When you look at the industry, I would welcome your thoughts. And I'll close my statement with a question. When you look at the industry from 2013 to 2020, U.S. higher education publishing, textbook publishing industry has shrunk in terms of revenue, right? They've gone from about $5 billion in 13. Presently, they're over $3 billion industry. And if you look at the market share, about 80% of the market share is owned by about five large players in the marketplace. Some are publicly traded, some are privately held. I wonder, circle back to the question that Representative Hawkins had around recycling books, that there's a pay change, right? And we have a new book, and the student's required to buy the new book. If, what are your thoughts around when we have non-material changes to the book? I mean, should we look at legislative action in terms of extending that from multiple years to a longer period where the students can use?
It's hard for me to say that. Let me answer your question a slightly different way. Let me talk about open educational resources for just a minute. Because my example I like to use is Shakespeare. We have a class in Shakespeare. One of the parts of the Florida Virtual Campus is our library system. We have massive amounts of content. And I would like to say that we have every play Shakespeare has ever written. And I'm not aware that he wrote any new ones. So we can use Shakespeare's plays forever. There's no change. There's no new plays. I think in some disciplines, it makes sense to use a book for a longer period of time. In others, it doesn't. And it may be a discipline-specific question. I think the textbook affordability statute, if I have it right, suggests 3 years, but it gives the institution the option to change quicker if there's a compelling need to do that. It's probably a good question for the panel that's coming up after me about that.
Premier Zika, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And just a brief follow-up. So when you look at the data, the market share is shrinking. We will see further competition, and the only way they can the players can remain relevant is by generating additional revenue, a certain gross margin. Do you see this improving over the next 3 to 5 years, or do you see the cost of post-secondary textbooks increasing in the marketplace? Because if you go back to your page 5, I mean, that orange line has exceeded the medical services cost in North America. So what are your thoughts around that?
I think it has to improve. If I were in the business of being a textbook publisher, it's not about only the content, because there are boatloads of content out there. As I mentioned, the Shakespeare plays. I mean, pick any discipline. There's tons of it out there. What a lot of publishers have attempted to do is put value-added resources around the textbook content. So when you purchase a commercial textbook or access to a commercial digital product, you're getting probably a test bank, a bank of test questions you can use. You're getting PowerPoint slides that you can use in your class. You're getting maybe study resources. And those have been aimed at the faculty. But we're also hearing some of the folks like OpenStax are also starting to put in. OpenStax is sort of a partner competitor with commercial publishers in a sense. They're starting to put resources around for student support, which makes a lot of sense now. If you're helping students be successful, that's a different product, that's a different mold, and that's an interesting tack, I think, to take, and that's maybe an area to expand the market that, in terms of competing over content, there's too much content out there. And faculty who write the textbooks at our college universities, in most cases, are now more and more developing their own content around their courses, because in the online world, if you think we're going to go online and we're going to have the best business program ever, there are maybe 300 business programs out there you're competing with. So how do you differentiate yourself in that market? Well, one way you can do that is to say to a student base, come to our program, we're accredited, you'll never have to buy a textbook. It's all included, everything's included. And we're seeing more institutions position themselves with that. And when in the face of that pressure, I think that industry is going to have to adapt.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Dr. Opper.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to move on to our panelists. And panelists, if you want to go ahead and come up, keep in mind that we only have about 40 minutes left. And if everyone uses up their entire 5 minutes, we're only going to have 10 minutes left for questions. So I'm going to go ahead and quickly introduce everyone. And Dr. Kinsey, if you want to start, and we'll go in this direction. I'll let you introduce yourselves. Your name tags are on there. If you just want to briefly explain who you are and where you're from and then go right into it, that'd be appreciated.
Good morning. Sandra Kinstein, Florida A&M University. I'll speak briefly about one of the initiatives that we've begun in academic year 2020. So FAMU, as part of the state university system, is committed to student success. And as part of ensuring that our students are meeting our graduation and retention goals, we have developed three specific initiatives centered around reducing the cost of textbooks for all of our students, particularly at the undergraduate level. One of those initiatives is providing English composition courses to our students at no cost. The second initiative is providing college algebra textbooks to students at no cost. And the third one that I want to talk to a little bit more about today is Inclusive Access, a partnership that we just began with a commercial vendor, Cengage Unlimited, as of fall 2020. Cengage Unlimited, if you refer back to Dr. Offer's presentation, is a commercial vendor, and we're using their product, Cengage Unlimited, which provides inclusive access to the entire catalog, which is well over 20-some thousand textbooks for our students. Students have access to the catalog regardless of the courses that they're taking, and this is particularly important for increasing retention among our students. An example would be if a student is currently registered for college calculus, in addition to downloading the ebook for calculus, they would also have access to the trigonometry and college algebra textbooks as a refresher. All of this is delivered to the students electronically through FAMU's learning management system, which is Canvas, and students may purchase their textbooks on or before the textbooks are delivered on or before the first day of class, because as part of our textbook adoptions, our faculty are ensuring that that information for all of the courses is posted at least 45 days prior to the first day of class. FAMU has a special negotiated price of $125 annually for students who are participating in the Inclusive Access Program. Dr. Offer mentioned that the cost of textbooks is approximately $1,300 annually, so you could calculate that savings if students are taking all of their courses utilizing Cengage materials. They're paying just over $50 per semester for their courses because the cost is $125 annually. In addition to students, Cengage also has faculty resources such as PowerPoints, additional instruction materials, test banks, and assessments. Students also have career access, career resources, materials as part of the subscription as well. And additional marketing solutions are underway for increasing the number of subscriptions that are available to students each year. In the first year, we sold 2,500 of those subscriptions, reducing the cost of materials, which is particularly important for FAMU as a large number of our students are African American from underrepresented populations. More importantly, we have a large portion of students that are first generation college students.
Thank you, Dr. Kinsey. Mm-hmm. Members, we're going to save our questions until the very end so that we can go ahead and move everyone through, because I do have questions as well. Vice President Provolis, you're recognized.
Good morning. Leah Provolis, AVP of FIU Online. In academic year 2021, FIU reported 75% of course sections offering no-cost to low-cost course materials. I'll review the initiatives that led up to that, beginning with affordability counts. Launched in 2016, this initiative is a result of the collaboration of three units at FIU, FIU Online, the FIU Libraries, and the Center for Advancement of Teaching. Affordability Counts aims to lower the cost of course materials to $20 or less per credit. Faculty are encouraged to adopt OER or other low-cost course materials. As part of the program, all qualifying courses earn the Affordability Counts medallion. In an evolution of this program in 2019, FIU Online partnered with five universities and one state college to expand the program statewide. The FIU Online team developed the landing page, affordabilitycounts.org, which is managed by them today. Via this website, users can access a searchable database of courses that use OER and low-cost materials. Faculty across the state can contribute to this database and or use it as a resource in their own content curation process during course development. In just 1 year, faculty at Florida State Colleges and Universities gained access to a statewide repository of model courses and their low-cost materials. SUS partners now include UCF, UNF, USF, Florida A&M, FAU, and Lake Sumter College. As of spring 21, 1,300 faculty across the state have participated in this program, with over 1,900 courses that have been awarded the medallion. At FIU, savings are nearly $116 per course, with an average cost of materials in Affordability Count certified courses at $19, accounting for over $2 million in cost savings for thousands of students. This figure doesn't include subsequent iterations of the course after the medallion was awarded, thus meaning that savings are in fact higher. Moving on to the efforts of the FIU libraries, FIU libraries provide open access, low-cost materials, as well as e-materials whenever cost-effective, feasible, and possible. Many faculty request e-books and other online material in their respective subject areas to be added to the catalog in electronic formats. This past July, the FIU libraries transitioned to a next-gen integrated library system with cloud-based services and a scalable web and mobile design that improves and expands access to library materials. Joining others in the state, the upgraded system fully integrates the library resources into the curriculum at zero cost to students. During the pandemic, the FIU libraries shifted to online support to faculty, identifying appropriate alternatives to print materials for their courses. HathiTrust Temporary Emergency Access was activated, enabling faculty and students to access many print items virtually. The libraries also accepted all vendor offers of free access to content. This additional content and HathiTrust were actively used by both faculty and students as new resources. The libraries continue to acquire new e-resources with unlimited simultaneous user access to be embedded in courses. The FIU libraries have accessed over 4.7 million items in electronic format, including e-books and streaming media. Our libraries subscribe to over 1,000 databases. Course reserves is another way content is made available to students free of charge by the FIU libraries. This can also take on many formats, housing course materials in print, electronic, and multimedia, all of course in compliance with copyright law. In the 2021 academic year, course reserve items reached over 13,500, an increase of almost 2,000 from the prior year. The library team continues to collaborate with faculty in finding OER materials for our courses. Our very own business and online learning librarian served on the Florida OER Summit 2021 committee in May, her service reaffirming FIU's support of OER initiatives. Our Student Financial Aid Office offers textbook advances. Students may apply for this advance, and this aid ensures that they can purchase their course materials prior to the start of the term, so they are prepared for class on the very first day. Almost 2.7 million of book advance aid was awarded in fall 20 and spring 21. Bringing us to our textbook affordability initiatives in partnership with Barnes & Noble. So starting with the basic options, rentals, used rentals, digital discounts, all these options amounted to $1 million in student savings for fall 20 and spring 21 semesters. The FIU and Barnes & Noble price match program is one where the bookstore is matching prices for textbooks advertised or offered by competitors, even Amazon, for a total of over $135,000 matched since inception. Bringing us to our latest initiative, which launched this fall, the FIU's Inclusive Access Program. At FIU, this program is called the Panther Book Pack, with an opt-out provision across all undergraduate course sections in fall 21. Priced at a flat fee of $20 per credit hour, this is a subscription-based rental program, differing from previous first-day initiatives that Barnes & Noble had offered, as those were flat fee per course and only offered digital materials through Canvas. The Panther Book Pack allows for any selection and format that Barnes & Noble supports. In Panther Book Pack, students are guaranteed to receive all course materials pre-selected by faculty prior to the first day of class by participating in the program. FIU and Barnes & Noble collaborated on a faculty and student communication campaign outlining details and expectations. Faculty use a portal to choose their course materials and formats. Upon registration, students receive communications from Barnes & Noble to make their selections as to how they will receive their print materials, namely whether pickup or delivery at an off-campus location of their choosing. and digital materials are accessed through an LTI that FIU has installed in Canvas. Student financial logistics are important to highlight as a benefit. The $20 per credit is applied to the student's FIU account and therefore falls under payment setup and timelines already established by student financials for all other student payments. The Inclusive Access Program supports affordability and also supports equity. Students have equal access to all materials on the first day of a class at the same time as everyone else. Students report that the beginning of the term is the most expensive time period for them. By participating in the Panther Book Pack program, they can gain access to materials by the first day, regardless of whether they depend on scholarship funds, financial aid, or VA monies to cover the cost of their course materials. It's a benefit they have due to the $20 credit being charged to their student account. To date, those are the FIU initiatives supporting low-cost, no-cost OER adoption, providing students with an array of affordable options.
Good morning. My name is Stephanie Washler. I represent Santa Fe College, and we do offer our students a variety of ways to save money on course books. Students may purchase used books, they may rent books, they may rent used books, they may purchase electronic course materials. We oftentimes try to use a single text over a series of courses, and we have a number of faculty-curated open educational resources, as Dr. Opper described. So I thought I'd give you a couple brief examples of each of these options. A course that all of us across the college and university system teach a lot of, which is intermediate algebra, Math 1033. For that course, we use a free electronic platform for homework and practice called My Open Math Lab, as well as an OpenStax textbook. So there's no textbook cost to any student who takes that class. There's an analogous Pearson product, a My Math Lab, which is, as Dr. Opper described, a textbook with a code that costs about $125. So our students there, we have about 3,000 students who take that course every single term, and that amounts to about $330,000 in direct student savings every term. Our English department also has selected one single inexpensive text. As Dr. Opper said, Shakespeare hasn't changed much. So we have one text that's about $90 that students purchase, and it carries them through ENC 1101 and 1102. In the past, students purchased two separate books for those courses that each ranged about $100 to $125. So we've cut the cost of that book series in half. And again, that's about 300,000 students an academic term, also coming in at around $300,000 in savings. Finally, to describe what Dr. Opper talked about in terms of faculty-curated open educational resources, we have a number of faculty who have joined together to create repositories of course materials that they provide to their students completely free. Through FLVC, there's a tool called Curriculum Builder that faculty can use to identify free resources that they can take and embed in a Canvas course shell that students can use. So we have, for instance, all of our faculty in general psychology have worked together to curate a curriculum through Curriculum Builder and their own expertise that is used by all Gen Psych students, again, completely free. We've done the same thing in Humanities 2020, a very common gateway humanities introductory course, as well as public speaking, again, a very common course. Assuming that, and that is about 3,100 students in academic term who take those three courses, again, resulting in about $300,000 in savings. So if we take those initiatives together, our students will save about $1.75 million in textbook costs every year. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Georgia Lorenz. I'm the president of Seminole State College of Florida. Am I not on?
Good morning. Sorry about that. I was on mute, I guess. I'm Georgia Lorenz. I'm the president of Seminole State College. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to discuss this hot topic with you this morning. I appreciate you shining a light on this important topic for our students. Seminole State recently launched our most recent strategic plan, which we call Flight Plan 2025, And one of our primary objectives is to remove any non-academic barriers for student access and success in post-secondary education. And of course, cost is top among those non-academic barriers. Seminole State engages in many of these same practices that the other colleges and Dr. Opper have outlined, so I don't want to repeat those in the interest of time. We are anxiously moving towards the adoption of open educational resources. Some of the advantages that you've heard is that students have perpetual, well, first of all, they're no cost. They have perpetual access to that content. And this is important for a variety of reasons. One is students often need that content in future courses. We also have students, you know, life happens and they may need to drop a course. If they have digitally rented that textbook, they lose access to that and would have to purchase it again. With open educational resources, it's theirs forever. They have access to that. They can also print it. They can also download it and use it when internet access is not available to them. And I think this is particularly important because the digital divide is real. That became very clear to us during the pandemic. And not all hardware and internet access is equal. And we invested some of our COVID relief dollars in giving students access to laptops with built-in Wi-Fi hotspots so that they could access materials. As digital textbooks gain in popularity and open educational resources, we are going to have to consider the cost related to that hardware and internet access. We also have to think about accessibility. Many of our students with disabilities have had trouble with digital textbooks. I know in my own experience, the publishers do not necessarily take responsibility for making those digital textbooks accessible. And it's the institutions who are held responsible for that accessibility issue. With OER, our faculty can work with accessibility specialists to ensure that those are accessible to all students from the outset. Part of our work is to stay abreast of developments in the field. So we've also looked at what other states and colleges and universities nationally have been engaged in. I've seen that states with successful initiatives invest in the development of institutional culture and capacity for OER. This involves professional development for faculty and resource staff, some level of infrastructure like a platform like Pressbooks, which I believe is used by Florida State College of Jacksonville, adapting our learning management systems to integrate those platforms, closed captioning for any videos that might be involved, and other accessibility manipulations that may have to be made to those open educational resources. OER development and adoption takes instructors about 180 hours, according to a recent national study. Several states, like Texas, Oregon, New York, and some others, have had competitive grants through their departments of education or similar agency. And we've seen with just a modest investment in those pilot programs, the results in terms of return on investment for students have been 800 to 1,000% within the first 2 to 3 years after that investment. And I could see that competitive grants here in Florida might be able to engender momentum towards the adoption of open educational resources. And I think this is particularly important for the high enrollment general education courses, which are common across all of our colleges by design. And, you know, Florida is consistently ranked number one in higher education nationally, which we're all so proud of. And the primary reason for that is quality. So whenever we're looking at open educational resources or a digital textbook, we have to keep quality at the forefront of our minds. And we rely on our faculty per accreditation and best practices as the experts in their field to develop the curriculum, and the course materials are a very critical part of that. So I would just caution us that we always have to keep quality in mind as we move forward. And also with any adoption of digital textbooks or open educational resources, sustainability is a really important factor. We can't do this once and then just use the same resources for forever. They need to be revised, and made sure that their quality remains high and the currency of the content remains relevant for our students. So they're always ready for what's next and what's coming down the pike in the future, whatever their field of interest might be. So I will leave it there. And again, I thank you for highlighting this very important topic for our students.
Good morning slash afternoon. It looks like we're right on the cusp there. I'm Melody Bowden, a professor of writing and rhetoric at the University of Central Florida. I'm also a textbook author and editor, and I serve on the University Press of Florida editorial board. And I've done a lot of focus groups with faculty and students on this topic, especially of opt-in, opt-out related to inclusive access programs. So those are sort of my frame of reference. I'm going to be that student who says, everybody already said my thing. So I'm going to just run through a few things that I think highlight some of UCF's real commitment to innovation in this area. And that includes a lot of work that comes out of our Center for Distributed Learning, where we are really leaders in developing learning objects that can be malleable and used across campuses. This is one of the big innovations that we've led that allows students to, you know, especially in a virtual environment, to interact really in exciting ways with information, move things around, twist it, that kind of thing. And one of our big challenges with that is it's difficult to share that across campuses. We have leaders on all of our campuses, intellectual, academic leaders, who have so much to share. If there were an infrastructure and a mechanism that made it better and more possible to share across campuses, we would really have an opportunity, I think, to leverage that quality that President Lorenz mentioned across the state. So that's one of the things I want to throw out. And UCF has a lot of capacity in that area and excellent expertise there, especially in the field of physics. We have some really outstanding accomplishments there. We have inclusive access programs. We have really well-integrated Pressbooks program. Many, many faculty members participate in this. We have these in-house programs that support faculty members as they develop these multimedia materials, which, of course, really we know is the cutting edge of learning at this point, really. You know, I'm an English professor, so I like my books. I like my Shakespeare. I still have all those books in my giant library. However, students really want more agile kinds of access, right? So we found during the pandemic, especially in those early days, there were students who, because of the actions that were necessary, they were not able to go back and get their physical textbooks. And they were locked in a dorm that they could not re-enter and access. And so we had to, many faculty members on the spot pivoted to open educational resources and those kinds of things. And we saw the possibility there. So that's one of the most important things for students, just to add one dimension that a lot of the other advantages to students have been discussed. But that's something, agile resources, and that's something I think open educational resources really bring. Another advantage that students see with open educational resources is, I mean, they think it's exciting that these materials were hand-selected by their faculty members. They have told us time and time again how much it means to them that their faculty members are not just buying a book off the shelf, that they are customizing this to the learning outcomes for that group of students, for that campus, and so on. So in 2020-2021, the use of free resources and open educational resources at UCF saved students $1,741,739. I like to get that full number in there. And our inclusive access programs over the years have saved more than $9.7 million. And so, so these are really huge accomplishments. I want to mention, there's an initiative that's being led by UCF, UF, and FSU right now, that group that meets on a monthly basis to talk about, I mean, you know, opportunities for funding come along nationally and on the state level, but almost always we're caught off guard by these, and we don't have a statewide initiative we're ready to get in there with. And this group invites everyone on this panel and across the state to be part of a conversation that they're having on a monthly basis to be ready for those. So we have the Digital Library of the Caribbean, which is one of the big projects, and there's also a general education program that they're working on so that we're ready to jump in there with proposals to seek funding. This is a resource, financial, physical, intellectual, resource-heavy endeavor to create these materials, but we find that it is very, very much worth it. So that's something that I would love to see some support for. And I think I'll leave it there because I know we want to have some discussions.
Good morning. Good morning, and thank you so much for the invitation to be here with you today. My name is Valencia. It's not. My name is Wendy Du. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Teaching and Learning at Valencia. I want to let you know that Valencia has been and continues to work really hard to ensure that cost-prohibitive textbooks are not a barrier for our students. That's a lot. We have a lot in common on our panel today. As we were reflecting on coming before you today, we really began to think about what's the core of the work, and we came up with four principles. The first is affordability. The second is quality. The third is ready access. So it can be accessed by the student on that very important first day. And lastly is a level of faculty choice, so they can assure that student learning and that the materials are aligned with the course and the course learning outcomes. We have used two prominent strategies to reduce textbook costs and better ensure learning. So first, over the last 10 years, Valencia faculty have developed their own instructional materials using resources available to students at no cost. Most of this work has been done by faculty who teach our highest enrolled courses, which makes the most impact on students more significant. This fall, 30% of our courses, that's about 1,980 classes, do not have any instructional materials at all for purchase. In 2012, the average cost of our textbooks per course was $126. Today, it's about $55. That represents a lot of work, but we have a long way to go. One of our longest-standing examples of this innovative strategy is the Valencia Reader and the Valencia Writer. These were developed by English faculty from all across the college. If you ask them, they will describe it as a living open-source textbook. They contribute to it every semester with all kinds of new editions of short stories, poems, plays, novels, and essays. It's a way to keep that material relevant. As our panelists have talked about today, mathematics faculty from across our campuses have also worked collaboratively to build a no-cost intermediate algebra course. This integrates a variety of the strategies that you've heard today. Open access resources, open educational resources, videos and other content made by faculty, free software, and all of this works together in combination to build an interactive experience for students that's really important to learning and practicing mathematics. Our entire Bachelor of Science degree is completely open source materials. As our work has continued this summer, we engaged 63 faculty together work together to collaboratively curate and develop OER materials for their courses. And a part of this experience, professional development is really important. We need to provide lots of support for faculty to navigate and locate OER resources and use them in their course. Throughout this experience, we've learned a few things. One, the work and the time and the resources to create or adopt these OER aligned with course outcomes is significant. And our faculty are supported by a team of instructional designers and librarians essential to the process. In addition, an extensive collection of library resources and databases are also important for quality. As Dr. Opper indicated, we've also learned that in some disciplines like nursing, allied health, computer engineering, there are limitations to our ability to create and sustain robust interactive resources essential to achieving the learning outcomes of the course. This is why the role of faculty and choice is very important. Our second strategy has been to significantly increase the use of digital materials that right now are at a much lower cost than printed textbooks. The use of these materials ensures that students have the necessary resources available on the first day of class. As you might imagine, during the pandemic, there have been supply chain challenges, and courses with digital materials have assured that students have those materials on the very first day. Last fall, 28% of our instructional materials were digital. In terms of student choice, we added a digital choice for all textbooks. When that option was available, Last fall, 23% of our students chose to purchase digital materials. I would imagine that our fall data this time is going to be higher than that. Looking ahead, we will continue to expand these two strategies with a focus on overcoming the associated challenges that you heard about today. Student access to technology, accessibility of OER, intellectual property, copyright, and sustainability of content. We also want to continue to consider the implications of the growing number of online and hybrid courses with the use of digital materials. We feel like that's synergistic. We want to build upon students' high school experiences where they're already using digital materials. And we want to take time to gather feedback both on student preferences and how digital and/or printed materials actually impact learning. As we've indicated today, the ability to annotate and write and read might be important. So as you consider to evaluate these options and make decisions, we hope that you will consider these four principles: affordability, quality, ready access, and a level of faculty choice. And we really just deeply appreciate your continued support of our efforts towards affordability, and we thank you.
Thank you, members. Representative Rizzo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everyone. That was a lot of good information there. Sounds to me like you've got this whole thing about, you know, keeping cost control, like you've got it. Sounds great. To Vice President Provolis. Pause up. Good to see you. You mentioned Barnes & Noble, okay, as I guess being the bookstore on campus. So my question is that something that throughout the university system we have a third-party vendor as the bookstore? Are there universities that don't have that are their own vendor? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So at FIU, they are our bookstore provider, and I believe our contract with them has some exclusivity in faculty choosing from their inventory the different available publishers and content. Was that your question, whether we do that directly with publishers or through Barnes & Noble?
No, actually, excuse me, Chair, thank you. It was actually... So they are your bookstore, right? So I want to know, is that something that is a rule throughout the college and university system? And if it isn't, then wouldn't, you know, have the universities thought of perhaps being their own bookstore, their own retailer, and wouldn't that lower costs in and of itself?
So is that a rule? I don't know the answer to that. But I think that likely our contracts outline different elements like that. I don't know if anyone else. Go ahead.
So it is not a rule that the state university system or the Florida College System schools contract with a bookstore chain. However, most of us are either Barnes & Noble or Follett. There are a very small number of institutions that still run their own bookstore. Is there anyone here who is?
My understanding, UF does a lot of
Yeah, I'm not aware. So traditionally, a lot of the colleges did do it themselves. However, when the major textbook, the bookstore companies, Follett and Barnes & Noble, came along, they offered greater convenience, taking the management of the bookstore out of the college. Colleges aren't necessarily business-oriented operations. They pay a small price back to the institution based on sales, so the institution makes a little bit of money off their bookstore vendor without managing the process of ordering books, staffing a bookstore, having an office staff and all of those things. But it's not required by statute.
And, Chair, I have one more question, and we'll start off with Dr. Kinsey, and then anyone else can answer. You mentioned, you know, and the cost savings that you went over are amazing. When you look at starting at from $1,300 a year to about $161 per student or less, I mean, that's amazing. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you is, are you able to do that because you have a like a licensing fee with the publisher? I mean, I'm trying to get to the economics of this, of how a university can lower the cost of books so much and you know, have students avail themselves of all these resources.
It is a special pricing with the commercial vendor, and the commercial vendor is Cengage. So, and that pricing is available only to FAMU students, and it's negotiated based on a particular volume of sales of the subscriptions annually. So that's how we were able to get it lowered. In negotiating with them, if we meet a certain number of students who are purchasing the subscriptions annually, we get to keep that low cost for 4 years, which is our contract. However, that contract does vary by institution based on the different deliverables and particulars. But for FAMU in particular, a lot of negotiation went into getting that price at such a low rate.
Okay. And I just have one last question, and that is for the open resource, open resources. So say, for example, I'm a professor and I want to add something to my reading list, okay? Is that process dexterous enough to be able to do that quickly? Within one semester, let's say, by the time I get there, you know, I'm a new professor and all that stuff. So just take me through that process.
For the open educational resources was your question. So I think the most challenging part for faculty is going through the repository and finding the content they like, but adding it to their course once they've figured out and curated the content that is relevant for them to add to their course is not something that is depending on the medium that they find it in the repository. So in some cases, it may be something they can download and upload into their course. In some cases, it may be something, access that they provide students where they go to a different website. So physically adding it, and I'm speaking for a Canvas shell right now in digital copies, is not what may take them a long time. It would be finding the appropriate content in such a wide array of options. And that's part of the reason the Affordability Counts program assists with that, because they can go in and they can say, okay, I teach a English course, since that's been the topic, and Affordability Counts will show them courses that other professors have already done that content curation. So they can look for their specific discipline and find what another faculty member from another institution has already searched the deep web for and has pinned to that discipline or that specific subject already.
Thank you. Nope, that's it.
Representative Hawkins, do you have a question? You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up on his second question, and this is really diving into the details because we're talking so much about cost. For those that sounds like all of you have a third-party provider doing your bookstore, if they're not providing the digital access, does your contracts prevent you? They have to approve who gives you the digital access? Or I'm sure there's download fees and things like that happen for the students, but I'm trying to figure out if they brought in another company to do the digital portion, is your third-party provider that currently does your bookstore going to ask for a percentage of that in your contracts? And you may not know that because it's really in there, but I'm trying to figure out, again, how we keep costs low and when people are trying to provide this access. And anybody can take that.
So for FAMU, we also use Barnes & Noble's as part of our third-party contract. Within the special pricing of the $125, that does include a small percentage of the management fee for Barnes & Noble's to do the management of the subscriptions given to the students. But as far as electronic delivery, that is coordinated between the commercial vendor and our Office of Instructional Technology at no additional cost, because Canvas is managed locally at the campus.
My only additional comment on that would be we really work directly with them to negotiate these prices in almost every case. And there are some examples where we might work directly with a vendor, but there is third-party involvement in that. That's part of our contract. We have a contract with Barnes & Noble that really gives them exclusive rights to sale of course materials on our campus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, but the open OER, open educational resource option, can completely bypass the bookstore. So just to make sure that that's clear to you. Yes. So, for instance, what I've described to you, similar to my colleagues as well, faculty have come together and they've curated an entire course, in our case using the Curriculum Builder tool through FLVC, but it sounds like there are other tools that I wasn't aware of that could be used as well. And faculty can find that content at a variety of libraries, in different repositories, in professional associations, and can be either downloaded into a Canvas shell or curated in some other way through links, and that's given directly to the student, completely bypassing the bookstore and any fee to the bookstore.
Dr. Du, did you make any kind of indication that Valencia does not have a contract with the bookstore? Is that correct?
We do not, except in a campus that we share with UCF. So we have our own bookstore, and that's something that we are constantly evaluating for cost. So I can't promise that that's a forever strategy. It's something that we're continuing to evaluate, but that allows us to negotiate all kinds of different prices and costs with publishers and other providers.
First of all, I want to thank everyone who came up and spoke today. This has been an incredible conversation we've had from our first presenter, Dr. Opper, to our panel that we have now, a wealth of information and knowledge that you brought to us here, things that we hadn't even encountered in a lot of our research that we've done over the last year. I want to thank the committee members. I want to say this has been a very engaged committee on this subject. I think it's important to many of us. A lot of the same sentiments and ideas that I have shared privately, I've heard reflected in a lot of your comments and a lot of your questions. So I want to thank the committee members as well for your engagement. And I encourage you to stay engaged. I'm going to have follow-up meetings with various people on this committee, and I hope you will as well. And I also encourage you to talk to some of the publishers. I've had a couple of them come by my office, and it's also good to get an understanding of their business model and some of the technologies that they have as well across the different companies. So this concludes our committee agenda. Is there any other business before the committee members? Good. Seeing none, Representative Hawkins, move we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.